This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Another month and another tepid unemployment report. The nation's unemployment rate just went up to 7.6%, with no prospect for a significant decline in sight. The plight of the long-term unemployed, who represent over 37% of the unemployed, is all but forgotten. Facing daunting odds in finding work, they are also being hit with federal unemployment benefit cuts that states have been forced to implement due to the sequestration, and now qualify for fewer weeks of unemployment coverage since the beginning of the economic crisis.
Long-term unemployment, a national emergency. Joining us is Christine Owens, Executive Director of the National Employment Law Project. And nearly 4 years after the end of the Great Recession, millions of Americans who want to work still cannot find jobs and continue to struggle to survive without a paycheck. And I have to say that lots of the last hired women who found jobs in the public sector have now been laid off, exhausted their unemployment benefits, and are being driven back down the ranks into the indigent in this country. So they can't find jobs. They continue to struggle, survive without a paycheck. Would you say that the stubbornly high ranks of the long-term unemployed represent a national emergency?
It is absolutely a national emergency, and it's a national scandal that policymakers don't treat it as such. We have almost 5 million individuals who are officially counted as long-term unemployed, but that number is a vast understatement. It leaves out more than 6 million individuals who have been unemployed for quite a long time and who want to go back to work but have become so discouraged that they've given up. It also leaves out more than 7 million individuals who are working part-time hours because they can't get full-time hours. So if you added in these folks who are actually among the officially counted, then we'd have a much higher figure of individuals who were long-time unemployed or underemployed. And that doesn't even take into account the fact that we have a lower rate of labor force participation, meaning people saying they want to work or they're unemployed. We have the lowest rate we've had in a couple of decades. If we had labor force participation levels at what they were at the time the recession began, there would be an additional 4 million workers in the labor force. So if we added all of these in, we're talking about multiple millions of long-term unemployed workers or people who need and want longer hours but cannot get them, and it is absolutely a national crisis.
Let's flesh out what this also means in the community to break down what that national emergency really looks like in terms of lost wages and so on.
What we know is that, let's take African Americans, for example, African Americans' rate of long-term unemployment is almost twice their share of labor force participation. So African Americans are about 12% of the labor force, but they're roughly 23, 24% of the long-term unemployed. We also know that African Americans are likely to come from neighborhoods of higher unemployment. So when you add together the problems of being in a neighborhood with higher unemployment to begin with, and then experiencing a disproportionate rate of long-term unemployment, it really is a disastrous situation. It's part of the reason for the disproportionate decline in income and wealth among African American families compared with white families over the last several years. The same would be certainly true for, you mentioned women and public sector jobs. 70% of the public sector jobs that have been lost since the recession began are jobs that women have lost. And of the women who have lost these jobs, 1 in 5 is a single mom. That means an enormous impact on those women and on those children. And these are effects that they're immediate, and that's pretty severe, but they are also intergenerational. The impact on the working mom in terms of job and income loss is a cost that her child or children will bear immediately and in the future as well.
Well, Chris, we can begin to visualize and experience personally, really, the consequences of the lost wages today, the less consumer spending, the enduring hardships suffered by families who will take years to recover from periods of long unemployment. Tell us of the other groups, too, to give a sense of the magnitude.
It is a problem that cuts across all ages, cuts across all racial and ethnic groups, cuts across all education levels and both genders, and cuts across industries and occupations. It is not limited to one group of workers or one region of the country. It is the case that some groups of workers experience the problem disproportionately. So, for example, workers who are over 55 overall have much lower rates of unemployment than younger workers, workers who are, say, between 18 and 24 years of age. But once an older worker becomes unemployed, she is much more likely to be long-term unemployed. And in fact, roughly half of the unemployed workers who are 55 years or older have been unemployed for at least 6 months or longer. And these older workers are also much more likely to experience a much more prolonged period of unemployment for a variety of reasons. There is age discrimination at work in the job market. There's also discrimination against people because they are unemployed. And when these older workers finally get reemployment, they more often than not do so at a substantial cut in earnings. And over their period of unemployment, they've depleted their retirement savings. Many of them have had to sell their homes or their mortgages have gone underwater. So while unemployment is a crisis across the board for everyone affected by it, I think for older workers, the problem of long-term unemployment is particularly severe because the costs that they bear are so substantial in the short run over sort of a longer period of time, and then they have much less time to sort of build up earnings again. And instead, many of them are facing retirements of economic insecurity and poverty, even though they have worked for most of their adult lives but had the misfortune of losing their jobs when they became a little bit older.
I assume that you would not suggest that sequestration hasn't even further exacerbated the situation.
It has absolutely made matters worse. The GDP numbers for the first quarter of 2013 came out probably a half a percentage point worse than economists had been predicting. That slower growth is probably the result of the cuts in government spending. Slower economic growth means less consumption, fewer jobs. Sequestration has absolutely had an impact in terms of public sector jobs and private sector jobs, since many private sector jobs are dependent on public spending. There is absolutely nothing about sequestration that will ease the crisis of unemployment or help boost job growth. It is a perverse, wrong-headed policy, which we will all pay the price for this year and in the future.
And of course, hundreds of thousands of unemployed workers have been really hard hit by these
Absolutely.
Severe reductions in UI benefits and unemployment insurance benefits.
That's right. The individuals who are on the federal unemployment benefits, which means that they've been unemployed for 26 weeks, have sort of gone through their state benefits and now have triggered on to the federal benefits, those benefits are being cut. And depending on when the states are able to implement those cuts, the cut in a weekly benefit will be anywhere from 10% to 20% of the benefit. And when you consider that average weekly benefits are only about $300, and for many people that's basically what they're relying on, absorbing that kind of a cut over a several-month period, it's going to push many more unemployed workers into poverty.
In addition to the
cuts in the dollar amounts of benefits resulting from the sequestration, long-term unemployed workers have also faced a reduction in the absolute number of weeks of benefits that they're entitled to. Up until last year, they were eligible in many states with high unemployment for a total of 99 weeks of benefits, and that included both the federal unemployment benefits as well as the state benefits. As a result of cuts at the federal level, that's declined quite significantly. It's now just in the neighborhood of 70 weeks altogether, and the unemployment rates in the states that would warrant those number of weeks have to be higher. So Congress both reduced the total number of weeks available to unemployed workers and increased the unemployment rates in the states in order to reach the highest level of weeks of benefits. And frankly, the economy is just not recovered sufficiently for those kinds of reductions. And obviously, for the long-term unemployed, the economy has not recovered at all.
It is really astonishing that federal lawmakers so lightly disregard the urgent need to address this emergency. In fact, one of the things that some of your writings and your colleagues have pointed out is that recently only a single lawmaker even bothered to attend the start of a hearing on the issue. So, what are the policy steps that can be taken to help the long-term unemployed and that clearly we have to impress upon our federal lawmakers who certainly have failed to rise to the challenge?
I want to address those, but if I can just comment on your question just now, because I think it is so telling that the sequestration's impact that lawmakers, members of Congress felt most immediately and directly and were sort of facing was flight delays as a result of furloughs of air traffic controllers. And Congress acted quickly to fix that problem before they were personally inconvenienced by it. If members of Congress had to deal with what it's like to be unemployed, to look for jobs constantly, to be more often than not even to hear a response, much less have an opportunity to interview, to try to get by on these unemployment checks, if members of Congress were at all in touch with what it's like for these unemployed workers, perhaps they would show the same kind of urgency about addressing the sequestration problems as they did when their own self-interest was implicated. In terms of what we need to do by way of policy solutions, more aid to the states so we can stop the bleeding of public sector jobs, which is hurting the workers who are losing those jobs and affecting private sector job growth in those states. Investment in public infrastructure. You know, the infrastructure in this country is in deplorable shape, and we could put millions of people to work repairing roads and bridges and shoring up national defense systems and the like. Investments in energy efficiency, which we know should be a national priority to address climate change. Investments in energy efficiency. Investments in refurbishing and renovating schools so we can make sure that our children are being educated in state-of-the-art institutions.
And I would certainly add to your list of infrastructure, rebuilding public housing.
Yep.
Should be built, must be built.
Absolutely.
Throughout this country to both put people to work and certainly to house the ever-growing number of homeless or
absolutely
people who absolutely cannot afford housing in this country.
One other thing, people who have had little to no prospect, particularly young men and women of color in our society who have had little or no opportunity to enter the workforce. How do we respond to what's the prospect there? What does that portend for our economy?
I'm afraid that given the austerity obsession in Congress and the seeming unwillingness or inability to address major problems like these and to really build toward the future, that without a real, either a sort of a sea change in our legislative landscape and or real grassroots activism that pushes, it's going to be continue to be a long, hard road. We know that we need to create opportunities, particularly for young people, young people of color, the urban poor. We need to create opportunities through expansion of Job Corps programs, AmeriCorps programs, other kinds of pathways into employment that will really open up the doors to opportunity for millions and millions of young people. We've long underinvested in that. We are continuing to underinvest in that. I think the one kind of ray of hope on that score is that people are generally concerned about what job opportunities are going to be for young people anyway. And that's kind of across the board. Even recent college grads with prestigious, expensive degrees are more and more finding that the only employment opportunities are in low-paid service jobs. And it may be that with growing concern about what the job opportunities are for those young people, there will be some potential for expanding consciousness and really investing in youth conservation corps type programs, programs that will really provide jobs for folks who otherwise have a great deal of difficulty gaining access to them.
Christine, any final message for our listeners?
The message for all of us is that we have to double down, hold elected officials accountable, continue to demand policies that really value work and recognize the role that work and workers play in a healthy economy, and not only job creation and unemployment and related benefits for individuals who have lost their jobs, but it's also things like raising the minimum wage and making sure our basic workplace protections, wage and hour laws, and worker safety laws are adequately enforced. We can't rebuild our economy on poverty wages, but unfortunately, that's the direction in which we're going. Most of the job growth since the recovery began has been at the low end of the wage scale, and unless we do something, we take affirmative steps to lift wages at the bottom, we really are faced with even greater income inequality and even more tepid recovery than what we've already experienced, and frankly, a future for not only today's workers, but for workers of tomorrow that is just not very promising.
Christine Owens, Executive Director of the National Employment Law Project, thank you for being with us.
I'm Susan Palmer. I'm an apprentice pipe fitter.
I worked for the Detroit Public Schools for 7 years.
Building doors for Chevy Traverse.
An out-of-work sheet metal worker, been laid off since April.
I worked at a university research center, and I was laid off in August 2010.
I was a marketing copywriter for several years.
I was a legal secretary at a large law firm.
I've been laid off since October of 08.
I've been out of work for over a year. My benefits will run out in 3 weeks.
3 months, January 2011.
In 4 weeks.
My unemployment benefits ran out yesterday.
My benefits take care of my rent and some bills. They're my roof over my head. They're my electric bills. They're my food.
It put a little groceries on the table and pay a few bills.
Rent, groceries, doctor's visits.
My health insurance.
Without the unemployment, I probably wouldn't have a home.
All I see in my future is living in my car.
Yeah, we're waiting for our home to be taken.
And I don't want to do that. As of today, I no longer have my lifeline. Do I pay this bill or do I buy my food?
We can get by on very little, but we can't get by on nothing.
You just have to say a prayer because I have no idea if the benefits are not extended. I really don't know what I'm going to do.
I don't know. I'm sorry.
I want Congress to extend the unemployment benefits immediately.
Immediately.
So people can have a chance to find work.
Not just for myself, for every unemployed worker out there.
This isn't something that they should be talking about or debating or blathering about.
We never asked to be laid off. This is something that we have no control over.
In 40 years, they've never not extended unemployment benefits when the unemployment rate was this high.
So what is the reason now? I don't understand.
I would ask all Americans to call their congressmen, to write their congressmen.
Send a letter, make telephone calls.
And keep calling them and telling them, look, we elected you, so please help your people.
Please tell Congress to extend the unemployment benefits now.
Every American needs to contact Congress.
So if you call now to do it for me and the unemployed like me, then these benefits will be here for you if you find yourself in our situation.
What's really wrong with the economy and why? Unemployment is still high, and job creation hasn't made a big dent this many years into the so-called recovery. Who has the best plan? Is it the Keynesians? On the other end, the austerics? They both neglect the economic elephant in the room. Spreading wealth to the wealthy keeps buying power away from the 99%. It simply does not lead to economic recovery. To talk about the economic elephant, we present Robert Reich, professor of public policy at UC Berkeley and former Secretary of Labor.
Hi, I'm Robert Reich, and I want to talk to you about what's really wrong with the economy and why. Now, 4 years into a so-called recovery, and we're still below recession levels in every respect except the stock markets. Total unemployment remains very high. Employment remains some 3 million below its pre-recession level. Labor force participation is at its lowest since 1979. The recovery isn't just losing steam, it never had much steam to begin with. And that's because so much of our debate over economic policy has been beside the point. On the one side have been Keynesians, followers of the great British economist John Maynard Keynes, who want more government spending and lower interest rates in order to fuel demand. Now, we did try a big Keynesian stimulus between 2009 and 2011, and the Federal Reserve is still keeping interest rates near zero. I do side with the Keynesians, but let's be candid. Keynesians don't have a clear answer for how much additional government spending is necessary in an economy like ours, in which wages keep dropping. On the other side are supply-side austerics, who want lower taxes on the wealthy and on corporations to boost incentives to hire and invest, and who see government deficits crowding out private investment. They've won the latest round by making the Bush tax cuts permanent for 98% of taxpayers, hiking Social Security taxes back up, and implementing the so-called sequester cuts in the face of stubbornly high unemployment. But supply-side austerity doesn't work. George W. Bush tried supply-side tax cuts for the wealthy in 2001 and 2003, and nothing trickled down. In fact, job growth slowed and real wages declined. Austerity economics, meanwhile, has proven a disaster in Europe. Slashing public budgets when unemployment is high and demand already weak has been shown to be a recipe for recession, making public debt even larger relative to the size of the overall economy. Both sides of the modern debate have neglected the elephant in the room, the economic equivalent of an elephant in the room, the scourge of widening inequality. When all of the economic gains go to the top, the rest of the population doesn't have enough purchasing power to keep the economy going. Now, we should have learned this lesson after 1928, when the top 1% got more than 23% of total income. The following year, the economy collapsed. The next time the top 1% got more than 23% of total income was 2007. Businesses won't hire and expand unless they have more customers, but most Americans can't spend more, and net exports can't possibly make up the difference. And that's why retail sales were down 0.4% in March, and consumer sentiment has fallen to its lowest level in 9 months. The vast middle class in America is running out of money. because real household median income keeps falling. It's down to $45,018 from $51,144 in 2010, and it continues to drop as most of the benefits are going to the top. Declining incomes in the middle, well, that people can't borrow and shouldn't even be borrowing when they have declining incomes. So one important way to get the nation back on track is to restore middle-class prosperity and reverse the trend toward widening inequality. The Great Depression finally ended with the massive Keynesian spending of World War II. The economy continued to expand after the war, though, because of policy changes in the 1930s that reversed widening inequality and spread the benefits of growth. Collective bargaining, the 40-hour work week, the minimum wage, Social Security, and then after the war, wider access to higher education. So what can be done now to reverse widening inequality? Well, first, award tax cuts to companies that link the pay of their hourly workers to profits and productivity, and that keep the total pay of their top five executives within 20 times the pay of their median worker, and impose higher taxes on companies that don't. Next, raise the minimum wage to half the average wage, and expand the earned income tax credit. Increase public investment in education, including early childhood education, and pay for all this by adding additional tax brackets at the top and increasing the top marginal tax rate to where it was before 1981, at least 70%. Even the rich would do better with a smaller share of a rapidly growing economy than a large share of one that is barely growing at all. Our political leaders in Washington have for now chosen supply-side austerity economics over Keynesian economics, and that's bad enough. Their inability or unwillingness to do much or anything about widening inequality will prove a larger error. Thanks.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.